This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We made a genuine effort to continue after the attacks by the US State Department last September, but unfortunately, we couldn't.
African Stream, an independent anti-imperialist media outlet, shut down last week after attacks by NBC, Voice of America, and former Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and deplatforming by most social media.
We have Zoran, a democratic socialist, who would you think this is a no-brainer? We're going to codify New York City municipal retirees' Medicare, traditional Medicare benefits. Yeah, I'm going to sign up for that. And he has it.
Did New York Democratic primary mayoral election winner Zoran Mamdani refuse to oppose the privatization of New York City's Medicare system?
Very few groups have ever managed to get themselves unbanned once they are on this list. And now Palestine Action is on that list alongside groups like Al-Qaeda.
Pro-Palestinian campaign group Palestine Action has lost a bid to pause the British government's decision to ban the organization under anti-terrorism laws pending their legal challenge.
The resistance has really been undefeated and undeterred.
We hear from International Action Center's Sarah Flounders about the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran and decades of U.S. sanctions, sabotage, and encirclement. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The independent anti-imperialist media outlet African Stream closed its doors last week after being attacked by NBC, Voice of America, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, then deplatformed by all social media outlets except X and Rumble. African Stream reporter William Sakawa recounted the chronology of attacks in a post on the X platform.
It is now a painful reality that the curtain is finally closing on African Stream. But before we go, we would like to put out the full story that led us here. Contrary to the widely held belief, the attacks on us did not start with Antony Blinken's malicious and baseless accusations on 13 September 2024. Blinken's attack was merely an escalation of a well-orchestrated ploy against us that had been in the works for months. The story begins 2 years earlier, in September 2022, when we arrived on the African media scene as an unapologetic, anti-imperialist, pan-African media outlet. Like any new media outlet, low numbers marked the first few months. We had less than 5,000 followers on Instagram by the time we clocked 9 months. Our coverage of often ignored or misreported African stories set us apart from the crowd, organically growing our following. We were the first English language outlet to cover and accurately report on the people-backed military takeovers in Burkina Faso, Mali, and later, Niger. This definitely helped to exponentially grow our numbers. By mid-2023, we had amassed over 1 million followers across all platforms. Between January and December 2023, about 10 million of you engaged with our content on Instagram and Facebook, an engagement rate higher than that of mainstream media outlets such as BBC Africa. This was a positive development, as it was a testament to the quality of our work, but it also put a mark on our backs. Within months, it became clear that we had ruffled the imperialists' feathers. The first attack came in June 2024. When the US-based national broadcasting company, NBC, accused us, without any evidence, of targeting black communities with misinformation. In an attempt to give credibility to their attack, NBC strategically assigned this sordid job to a black journalist, Makui Francis. The NBC article was primarily based on a report by an entity called Onyx Impact, which days earlier claimed African Stream was one of 6 media outlets spreading misinformation to 40 million black Americans. The NBC piece, just like the summary provided by Onyx, did not provide evidence of the supposed misinformation. The Onyx summary did not even mention us, and a year later, they have yet to publish the full report. Our request for the full copy went unanswered, which was not only unprofessional, but also raised our curiosity about who Onyx Impact is. After conducting some research into Onyx Impact, we discovered that its CEO, Esosa Osa, is a close ally of Democratic politician Stacey Abrams.
Osa served as a senior advisor in Abrams' 2022 Georgia gubernatorial race and is also the former deputy executive director of Fair Fight Action, an organization founded by the Democrat politician.
It became clear that our only crime was to expose the fact that Democrats are no better than the Republicans when it comes to dealing with Africans at home and abroad.
opposition aligns with that of our revolutionary ancestor Malcolm X, who described the US two-party system as choosing between a wolf and a fox. No matter what, they'll both eat you. A few hours before the NBC article was published, Makui emailed us for a response to Onyx accusations. However, he only gave us a very short deadline to respond, and hours later, he moved it even closer, making it clear that he wasn't really interested in our response, but was merely ticking the right of reply box. However, he did eventually get a response from us after his article was published. Our response not only addressed the baseless allegations, but also addressed his employer and his role there. He interpreted this as an attack, ran for cover, and changed his Instagram account to private to avoid further scrutiny from us and our followers, who did not take kindly to his accusations against us. The NBC's attacks were soon followed by those from their brothers in imperialism, The Voice of America, VOA. In two hit pieces published in late August 2024, VOA smeared African Stream as an Iran-linked propaganda outlet, whitewashing Al-Shabaab, a group we have always criticized. They claimed we were distorting the US military activities in Somalia. The hit pieces were in response to an article we had published showing how all US presidents since George W. Bush, Republican or Democrat, had rained bombs on Somalia. Just like the NBC, VOA could not provide any evidence of what precisely the distortion in our article was. To avoid a taste of what NBC's Makui got, VOA hid the name of the author of the hit pieces behind a pseudonym, but not before we had already picked it up in an earlier version of the first article. The author was Purity Mombia, a VOA Kenyan journalist who earned her bread by attacking progressive African governments and organizations. As expected, we professionally responded to the VOA article, addressing each of the ludicrous claims one by one. Less than a week after our response to the VOA, the puppet master, Blinken, finally came out to attack us directly, probably after realizing the shoddy job their cronies were doing.
RT also secretly runs the online platform African Stream across a wide range of social media platforms. Now, according to the outlet's website, African Stream is, and I quote, a pan-African digital media organization based exclusively on social media platforms, focusing on giving a voice to all Africans both at home and abroad. In reality, the only voice it gives is to Kremlin propagandists.
As had become the norm, Blinken provided no shred of evidence to support his allegations. However, this did not stop the social media giants from taking down our accounts. YouTube did so within 24 hours of Blinken's baseless accusations. Meta and TikTok quickly followed suit. Google also locked us out of our drive and emails, resulting in the loss of over 2 years of work. As this was unfolding, another attack targeted us, this time around, by the Stanford Internet Observatory. As usual, the article authored by Stanford's Shelby Grossman and David Thiel did not give any substantive evidence, but merely parroted Blinken's claims. Strangely, in the analysis, Grossman and Thiel used YouTube numbers from a few days before Blinken's announcement, meaning they were aware of Blinken's plan before he made it public, a sign of a well-coordinated ploy against us. Later, Grossman took things personally and went on a rampage on X, warning people about us being Russian propagandists. We responded to her hit piece, highlighting her misunderstanding of Pan-Africanism, why she failed to see the link between Africa and the struggles of Black Americans. She later on claimed that we had unleashed our supporters to attack her. We did no such thing, despite her and Thiel publishing the personal details of some of our journalists. Coincidentally, the attacks from Blinken and other Democratic-aligned entities came just 2 months before the 2024 US elections. Someone was worried about the influence that we had among the African population in the US, a significant voting bloc for the Democrats. They knew that the easiest way to cripple us was to hit our bank accounts. It is probably the reason that even X, the only major social media platform that did not take down our account, still demonetized it, making it impossible for us to raise the necessary revenue. The accusations of being Russian agents also scared potential investors and advertisers of a fear that the US may equally target them, thereby exacerbating our financial woes and consequently making it increasingly challenging to carry out our work. Ultimately, this led to the painful decision to close our beloved company, a company where we had invested a significant amount of effort and resources over the last 3 years. While the attacks and the eventual closing of our company are heartbreaking, we walk away with our heads high. When we started this project, we were not naive. We knew that our anti-imperialist stance will set us up on a collision course with powerful forces who are eventually going to come after us. However, it was a historic mission for which we were prepared to give our all without fear or favor, and we believe we have delivered on it. May the fighting spirit of the African people live longer and keep the fire burning. We are all African Stream.
That was African Stream reporter William Sakawa on the chronology of attacks on the African Stream media outlet. This is Executive Editor Ahmed Caballo's Farewell, also published on the X platform.
Hi everyone, I'm very sorry to announce that African Stream is closing down. I know this will be disappointing to many of you who have supported us from the beginning. It's disappointing to us too. We made a genuine effort to continue after the attacks by the US State Department last September. But unfortunately, we couldn't after US Secretary of State Antony Blinken called us Kremlin propagandists. We were removed from YouTube within 2 days, Instagram within a week, and TikTok within 2 weeks. Additionally, we were demonetized on X. Across all platforms, we had over 2 million followers, and all 2 million were passionate about seeing our beloved continent reported on properly and fairly. After the attacks, our ability to generate income was killed. We were unable to travel to many of the essential locations we had planned, and we were barely able to continue running the business that so many of you have come to love. I'm not saying all this so that you feel sorry for us. You shouldn't. We take immense pride in our accomplishments at African Stream. We started this because we were passionate about accurately reporting on the most important continent in the world and doing so from a pan-African and anti-imperialist perspective. We reported from Benin, Nigeria, Ghana, Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, Liberia and South Africa, as well as many other important locations throughout our continent and beyond, which were often neglected and misreported by the mainstream media. Due to our work, we were invited to conferences and workshops in Iran, Cuba, Tanzania, Venezuela and Eritrea. We wanted to make an impact, and alhamdulillah, we definitely did that. Before us, there were very few places on Instagram where you could find educational and informative news about the continent. Today, there are numerous brilliant Pan-African pages and new ones emerging every day. The space is now infinitely richer, and that's not because of us, but because of you, the audience. You show that there's an appetite for African-centered news delivered by radical young Africans. We had the best followers assembled on any page. The richness of the discussion in the comments section, the feedback, the stories you asked us to cover in the DMs, the guests you introduced us to, none of this would have been possible without your contribution. Finally, I'd like to thank my team, a group of 20 and 30-year-old Africans, one 40-year-old and one 45-year-old, shout out to Ken and Jeffrey, managed to catch the attention of the world's biggest, most powerful empire, and for that, we can hold our heads high. I'm sorry if you feel let down. We gave it our all. I moved with my wife and newborn baby to Nairobi, Kenya to set up African Stream. My eldest son was born a couple of weeks after we launched. We gave it our all, but now it's time for you all to step up and pick up the baton. Keep talking about our continent. Keep posting about our continent. And keep exposing the role of imperialism in our continent. We are all African Stream. Forward ever, backwards never. Desperado.
That was Shelly Papi, Laho. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. New York City is struggling over the privatization of Medicare. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer interviewed WorkBite senior editor Joe Maniscalco about the fight to defend Medicare and why Zoran Mamdani, who was elected as a democratic socialist, refused to take a position opposing the privatization of the city's Medicare system.
So, Joe, first of all, why don't we talk about this long struggle? It's been a very important struggle in New York labor around protecting Medicare and what happened in that struggle.
Yeah, so you grow up in New York City, you know, for generations of New Yorkers. At some point, your parents told you, yeah, do what you want to do, but as a fallback, always get a good city job. Always have a good city job lined up. And what a good city job has always meant was a pension and health care that you would have when you get old. And you wouldn't. Yeah, so that's what was always considered a good city job, a pension and health care. I mean, that's That's what generations of New Yorkers plan their lives around. You know, I would speak to retirees all the time who said, you know, this is what we did 40 years ago, you know, myself and my partner. We decided one person would go into private sector, another person would go into civil service so that one of us would have that guaranteed health care. Now, with the Medicare Advantage push, that is all thrown away by the wayside.
And unfortunately, as I understand it, not only are the private insurers like United Healthcare pushing but United Medicare Advantage, but also the unions have gone along. Why don't you explain that process of how the unions ended up both supporting Medicare Advantage and also telling workers that they had no choice as far as Medicare?
Yeah, like what happened in New York City was, you know, unique to this city, but it also runs parallel to what was happening nationwide, where labor, you know, on a national level, as you know, has really embraced privatization, really embraced Medicare Advantage. In New York City, it goes back to the Bloomberg years when, you know, during his 12 years, you know, in office, he didn't settle any union contracts. So when Bill de Blasio came in around, like, you know, in 2014, he's like, oh, yeah, we're going to take care of these contracts. We're going to give people the raises. But I need like $600 million in healthcare costs savings, because the city of New York, since for the last 50 years, always covered that 20% that Medicare doesn't pay. So basically what happened is a lot of the public sector unions here in New York City threw their retirees under the bus. They say, like, yeah, we'll get the raises, but we're going to use a fund that was set up, health stabilization fund, we're going to use that to pay for it. And then in doing so, they promised that they would find $600 million a year in savings. And the way that they were able to do that was Medicare Advantage.
Well, how has that affected the retirees and other workers who were forced into Medicare Advantage?
I can't tell you, Steve, how many retirees I've, you know, interviewed over the last 4 years who just devastated by this. And these are people who either started out the Medicare Advantage fight battling serious life-threatening illnesses or developed life-threatening illnesses during the fight. And their lives, their retirements, number one, are shattered, because instead of going on a trip to see the world like they planned, they're out on the streets in all kinds of weather protesting this push, you know, and they're just... There's no end to the horror stories of the people who have Medicare Advantage here and in other states. They go to the doctor to use it, and they can't get the care that they need.
And United Healthcare has been making a lot of money, even using AI to deny people benefits. Is that part of what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, things were bad enough before AI, and now you have these algorithms, you know, playing a part. You know, it's hysterical. Remember, you know, back in the day, crazy Sarah Palin, all these death panels that's going to determine, you know, if you get health care, if, you know, if we have socialized medicine. Well, here you have totally privatized medicine, and you actually do have a, you know, dehumanized cold system that is determining whether you get the health care you need to live or die.
And this movement against Medicare Advantage, against privatization, and the deal that the New York Municipal Union leadership made, apparently they've had some success with lawsuits and fighting the implementation of this.
So the main group of retirees that have been fighting this in the court is the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees. And they racked up 11 straight wins in the courts, blocking the Adams administration from implementing the Medicare Advantage plan. Just last month, They lost a really important case. It was referred to as the nuclear option case. The New York State Court of Appeals, the highest court, ruled in the mayor's favor. And so you would think that, oh, he's going to roll ahead and do this. 2 days later, he announced that he was abandoning the Medicare Advantage push.
So Adams actually caved in and agreed to go along with the demand of retirees and people who have been put into Medicare Advantage, that they don't have to go in that.
Yeah, at this time, he said, like, he's citing the cost. The costs weren't a problem, this whole time, the last 3 years, he's been around, but now it's a problem. I don't know. It might have something to do with his re-election campaign, Steve. I'm not sure. But
that might be. Let's talk about how that figures in the primary, because this is an important political issue. And actually, elected politicians who supported the fight against Medicare Advantage were actually retaliated against by some unions, weren't they, in the case of AFSCME or some unions?
Yeah, DC 37, District Council 37, is the largest public sector union in New York City. And their executive director, Henry Garrido, is one of the main architects of the Medicare Advantage push in New York City. And he's on record saying, like, we are going to go after any city council person. We're going to use our resources to go after them if they support the retirees and their legislation in the New York City Council. They have a bill, Intro 1096, that would codify their existing healthcare benefits and stop the Medicare, anybody else, any future mayor, from trying to push them into Medicare Advantage. And he's definitely, that was one of my headlines. He's scaring the bejesus out of New York City Council members who are, you have city council members here who were on the Intro 1096 and then hopped off when they got spoken to.
And also, apparently, the retirees chapter of AFSCME was actually put in trusteeship.
It's still in trusteeship. DC 37 Retirees Association, the AFSCME actually swooped down and suspended all the offices and, changed the locks on the doors. And it's still in the receivership. They claim it was because the group was really loose in their financial filings. They lost their nonprofit status. And like you talk to everybody, it's like, that was a minor thing. They got it back. If that was a rationale, why not take them out of receivership? Because they've cleared up their IRS issue. They have their nonprofit status back, but they're still in receivership. And that group had been part and parcel of the push against Medicare Advantage. They had members that were also members of the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees fighting the Medicare Advantage and the push. And they donated to that cause.
And this is figured into the election. Now, why don't we talk about the candidates that ran? I mean, Adams apparently changed his position after the court decision. But ma'am, Danny, what was his position?
His position was really no position. I mean, the retirees held a candidates forum in the spring, and they got seven candidates on there, including, right-wing people like Curtis Sliwa. And all those people on that stage pledged to support the retirees, except for one, Whitney Tilson. But even he, a hedge fund guy, changed his tune later on. And now he's against Medicare Advantage. But noticeably absent was this big, scary socialist that everyone is supposed, every established person in New York City is supposed to be afraid of, was not there. And you talk to Marianne Pizzitola, head of the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees. Zoran hasn't spoken to us. He hasn't been to any of our events.
And why is that? Why do you think he hasn't? I mean, it seems like a straightforward issue, protecting Medicare and stopping the privatization.
I mean, that's the point of my whole reporting. It's like, if you're a Democratic socialist, you think that this would be a no-brainer for you, that you would totally engage with this group fighting the Medicare Advantage push, and you would sign their pledge. They have a pledge that you will fight against the Medicare Advantage push. WorkBites talked to Zoran last year, and we asked him point blank, where are you on this? And he gave us, Steve has just really served up a lot of weak tea, basically saying, things are going to be so good when I'm mayor that Intro 1096 won't be needed. I was like, well, maybe that's all well and good, Zoran, but what happens after you're gone? And another mayor.
Also, isn't this a national issue? I mean, the whole issue of privatization of Medicare is a national issue. In fact, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wants to privatize Medicare with Medicare Advantage. United Healthcare, Brian Thompson was assassinated or killed and around this issue of what they're doing to people who need healthcare. Why would he not take a position? It seems very strange since he calls himself, as you say, a democratic socialist.
Well, he was and he is Henry Garrido's and DC 37 number two pick in the mayoral primary. You know, that's the largest public sector union in the city. You know, he definitely wants that endorsement. He doesn't want to see that endorsement pulled away from him.
So you're saying this one union official, union bureaucrat, may have taken away his endorsement if he'd come out against Medicare Advantage.
Well, you have somebody who's on the record of telling people who have office and they want to hold on to their seats or people seeking office, that you're going to face the wrath of Henry Garrido and DC 37 if you support this bill. And we have Zoran, a Democratic socialist, who would you think this is a no-brainer? We're going to codify New York City municipal retirees Medicare, traditional Medicare benefits. Yeah, I'm going to sign up for that. And he has it.
And what does that say, not only about him, Zoran, but also about the trade union movement? Because obviously privatization is the agenda to destroy any kind of public health care. And now the destruction of Medicaid under this bill of Trump will force, you know, millions of people off of health care, close nursing homes. People are going to die as a result of that. What is necessary to really have a united fight of all working people to protect healthcare and actually get national healthcare?
Well, I mean, I think working people are behind that. That's what they want. But unfortunately, this case, you know, calls to mind a bigger issue of the struggle within the labor movement that's been going on, you know, for the last 75 years. You have a split between class struggle unionism and the business unionist, you know, who act like junior partners of the boss. And that's the situation you have here. You know, it's, you know, like we're talking about DC 37 and there's other heads of labor union here in the city that were for this Medicare Advantage push. Then again, there's others that I talk to that had their own unions that tell me point blank, Joe, I have no respect for any labor leader that does this, that gives away our public benefit. Just straight up. And others who have written it into their bylaws that whoever comes after me can't do that.
And isn't it the case that even some union officials like the Teamsters are getting money from these insurance companies? Emblem, they're on the boards actually of insurance companies?
Yeah, they're on the boards of insurance companies. There's brokerage fees and finder's fees and things involved in that. Yeah, it's yeah. I always like point out to people, like, what happened, you know, before SAG-AFTRA went on the strike, which everybody employed it. They had a major schism in their own union. And a lot of that had to do with healthcare. And Fran Dresser crowd, you know, they prevailed in that fight, but they totally embraced Medicare Advantage.
That was New York Work Bites senior editor Joe Maniscalco speaking to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
My friend, they don't care if you're an individualist, leftist or rightist, a shithead or a snake. They will try to exploit you, absorb you, confine you, disconnect you, isolate you, or kill you. And you will disappear into your own rage, into your own insanity, into your own poverty, into a word, a phrase, a slogan, a cartoon, and then will tell you that there is no ruling class, as they organize their liberal supporters into white supremacist lynch mobs, organize their children into Ku Klux Klan gangs, organize their police into killer cops, organize their propaganda into a device to ossify.
That was Jane Cortez and the Fire Spitters. There it is. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. In a significant step in the steady erosion of civil liberties, the High Court in London has upheld the UK government's move to ban Palestine Action as a terrorist organization. The decision came after the group lost a bid to pause the ban pending a full legal challenge. The ban was announced following incidents at a Royal Air Force base where activists targeted military planes with red paint. Palestine Action has been vocal in its opposition to the arms industry, particularly targeting facilities linked to Israeli weapons manufacturer Elbit Systems. Phil Miller, editor of Declassified UK, reports from the High Court in London, where Palestine Action tried to stop the government from banning the group on Friday, July 4th.
Are the people behind me terrorists? MPs have voted that they are. Politicians in the House of Lords also think that they are. But what do judges in the High Court think about Keir Starmer's plan to ban Palestine Action as a terrorist organisation? I'm outside the Royal Courts of Justice in London, where Palestine Action are trying to stop or at least delay a law that would make membership or even support of their group punishable by up to 14 years in prison from midnight tonight. I'm about to go inside to listen to this landmark case, which has huge implications for civil liberties. First, listen to what the protesters have to say.
Zionism is obviously in crisis. It can't sustain itself, and that's why its staunchest allies in the British Empire are engaged in this staggering assault on our civil liberties, all right? Those terrorism powers were pioneered as part of the colonial project in Ireland. They were obviously designed to attack groups like the Provisional IRA and so on, but they are now being wielded against people who do not engage in any violence against people. Speaks to the sheer weakness of Zionism. Keir Starmer and his cabinet of lying war criminals are pathetic and weak. They are not strong enough to stop us.
I'm a healthcare worker, and I had the deep privilege of working with our Palestinian colleagues in Gaza. I have seen terrorism, but it is not here. It's the Israeli drones circling the sky above Gaza. Yeah. It's the Israeli warships off Gaza's coastline. It's the Israeli soldiers who pointed their guns into our ambulance, directly at me and my colleagues, as we carried patients from Gaza City. Terrorism is the IOF. Yeah. Terrorism is the UK government's unfettered support for a genocidal state. Shame.
I've just come out of the High Court, where the case is being heard in a room right up there behind me. And Huda Amori, the co-founder of Palestine Action, is being represented by one of the lawyers that took the genocide case to the International Court of Justice. And she said that the situation in Gaza is an annihilation, it's a genocide, and Israel has dropped the equivalent of 6 Hiroshima bombs on Gaza using fighter jets which have components made in Britain. She said that people in Britain are horrified at seeing the massacres live streamed and knowing that some of the weapons used come from the UK. And at that point, the judge stepped in and said, surely since Labour introduced a partial arms embargo in September 2024, there are no longer weapons being sent from Britain to Israel for use in Gaza, save for the F-35 fighter jets. Huda Amori's barrister responded by saying that is a very big save for when fighter jets are being used to massacre Palestinians on a daily basis. And she said it was deeply ironic that on the very same day the Labour government tried to ban Palestine Action, it had also been celebrating an anniversary of the suffragettes who used explosives in their campaign of direct action for equal rights. Palestine Action's defense team also pointed out that terrorism, although it can mean serious damage to property, normally involves the use of explosives or release of chemicals, in other words, dangerous means with which to damage that property, and not just the application of paint. They also pointed to recent case law from Europe and environmental protests in the UK, where protesters have been found to be within their rights to, for example, spray paint on Van Gogh paintings and statues of historic figures. Palestine Action have also complained to the judge that the Home Office's decision to ban their group appears to be based on representations from the Israeli government, pro-Israel lobby groups, and Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms company, which makes 85% of the drones used in Gaza. The judge asked, why is it unlawful to take representations from the Israeli government and Elbit Systems? To which Palestine Action's lawyers pointed out that it's not their constitutional role to advise the British government on terrorism legislation. Palestine Action have also pointed out that it's unprecedented for a group which attracts so much public support to be prescribed as a terrorist organisation. They said they had over 20,000 people on their mailing lists, 250,000 followers on Twitter or X, and around 400,000 followers on Instagram. They also referred to the support they've received from the celebrated Irish writer Sally Rooney, as well as the Guardian columnist George Monbiot, who said this in a recent video to Double Down News.
This, I believe, needs to be our I'm Spartacus moment, where one after another we stand up and say, I support Palestine Action. I support Palestine Action. If tens of thousands of us do that, well, what are they going to do? Are they going to arrest and jail us all as sympathisers with terrorism just by saying that we support a non-violent protest movement?
So I've just come out of the High Court where the judge has ruled in favour of the Home Office. This means that from midnight tonight, Palestine Action will become a banned terrorist organisation, unless its legal team can somehow overturn that decision at the Court of Appeal in the next few hours, which seems extremely unlikely. We haven't yet seen the judge's reasons for reaching this ruling, as it's literally just been handed down. But we know that earlier today, the Home Office argued that it wasn't this court's jurisdiction to make decisions about which group should be listed under the Terrorism Act. That law has a specific body set up called the Prescribed Organisations Appeals Commission. It's a very secretive and little known body. Very few groups have ever managed to get themselves unbanned once they are on this list. And now Palestine Action is on that list alongside groups like Al-Qaeda. Being a member or even just a supporter of the organisation could result in 14 years of imprisonment. This takes us into completely uncharted territory.
That was a report from Declassified UK, published just hours after the UK High Court's decision to criminalise support for Palestine Action under the nation's terrorism laws came into effect. The court decision makes expressing support for Palestine Action a crime punishable with up to 14 years in prison in the UK.
Ibrahim Abu Thuraya could resist without a wheelchair. 10-year challenge, tell Reg if we are still here. And tell that killer Netanyahu he should feel fear. The old live through us and guarantee the children will care. Criminal, not invincible, and you know it. Sama Doon still sitting in their stoic. May not feel us with you when you listen to our poems. You inspire humanity, your resistance is heroic. Regardless of talk, it's time we answer the call. Through your strength of spirit, you provide example for all. How to live, how to love when attacked from the clouds above. Loud and clear, the songs you sung can't be drowned by the sound of guns. Won't just watch your tragic times through a satellite dish. The least that we can give you is an anthem like this. They panic, try to analyze and sanitize this. But we love you more than ever still. Palestine lives.
That was Loki, Long Live Palestine, Part 3. The U.S. and Israeli war in Iran and decades of U.S. sanctions, sabotage, and encirclement continue. Genocidal Israeli attacks in Gaza escalate. Sarah Flounders, director of the International Action Center, spoke at a virtual meeting organized by Pacifica Fightback on July 5.
It's important that we're having this discussion. It's needed because it's what the corporate media won't tell you. And it is a role for which Pacifica Radio was founded, to tell you what the corporate media won't tell you, and especially in times of war. So I was asked to speak particularly on Iran today, and I want to open by expressing my solidarity with the Iranian people and the Palestinian people who are under horrific attack. Last weekend, there were actions in 70 cities across the U.S. On the right to resist, the defense of Iran, and of course, the defense of Palestine and Palestinian resistance. That was organized by the United National Anti-War Coalition, along with many others. Now, I've had the opportunity to travel in past years to Iran, to Iraq, to Syria, Lebanon, throughout the region in many trips and delegations to Gaza, challenging U.S. attempts at complete corporate domination and control. I've seen also the ruin that comes with U.S. wars and the determination to gain control of a region, and the determination of the people of these countries to get the U.S. and all the old colonial powers out. When the Western imperialists are kicked out, even for a short time, you can see a remarkable transformation. Now, I think after these past couple of weeks, we should really take heart that the world is changing dramatically, and U.S. plans sometimes go disastrously awry, and then they just try to change the topic after they've had a real setback. So it's important to look at it, look at what's happening now, and also look at the scale of the destruction that continues in Gaza today. But the resistance has really been undefeated and undeterred. Now, in Iran, 3 weeks ago now, there was a totally unprovoked, targeted attack by Israel that, as Trump bragged the day after, three waves of 300 bombers from Israel attacked in a surprise attack on Iran. And Trump said it was planned for months. And it took place while he was assured the Iranians that it wouldn't happen because they were in negotiations. So it's another example of complete duplicity. But in it, the United States has suffered a spectacular setback in its attempt to destroy Iran, and it was a public setback. And it confirmed that Israel and Zionism, that's been unable to defeat 2 million Palestinians in Gaza in the last 22 months of the most savage genocidal attacks. And here they thought that a surprise attack on Iran, a country of 90 million, could change their fortunes. Now, it just shows the arrogance and thinking, well, with U.S. equipment, they could do anything. And it turned out not to be true. Instead, it was the Zionists who were dashing to bomb shelters, clawing at each other, pushing others out. Now, the U.S.-Israeli effort to destroy Iran and using fleets of U.S.-supplied equipment and Israeli bombers in this surprise attack during the negotiations, when it was least expected, they were able to kill in one blow Iran's top military command and top scientists in their homes, not expecting it, late at night. Trump gloated and proclaimed publicly his role in using the negotiations to catch Iranian government officials off guard. He actually, the next day, demanded Iran's complete surrender. Now, instead, Iran in self-defense responded using missiles that they had crafted on their own that were amazingly able to break through Israel's Iron Dome that they had bragged for years. They were untouchable. They were invincible. Suddenly, they were cowering in the bomb shelters, clawing each other, barring the door to African and Asian workers they had brought in to replace the Palestinian workforce. They suffered one blow after another as the Iron Dome wasn't able to stop the responding Iranian missiles coming in self-defense. And as Israel bombed Iran, Iran was able to hit back, hitting major fuel centers in Haifa, the stock exchange, the ports, military targets. It showed Israel was not untouchable. Netanyahu openly pleaded with the U.S. to intervene. And again, in full duplicity, Trump said he would consider it and respond in 2 weeks. And that very night, he sent B-2 bombers. Again, in a surprise attack, they dropped humongous payload on Iran's nuclear energy center, which was a small center for making nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, as Iran has maintained for decades. It's still far from military-grade enriched uranium, but the bombing failed. There was a big miscalculation, and it really backfired. Instead, it united further Iran. And so the ability to both retaliate and to move the materials out of the Fordo and Natanz and Isfahan centers, to move all nuclear materials away, that the bombing really did nothing. That's important. The Fordo enrichment site is buried under a mountain, and even US B-2 bombers couldn't destroy it. Now, this past March, we should just be clear, the vast US intelligence community, the largest in the world, had assured Congress that Iran was not in the process of building nuclear weapons. And a conclusion that was also reached by the very compliant International Atomic Energy Agency. Nevertheless, Trump ignored all this. And when challenged, the Secretary of State, Rubio, simply said, intelligence is irrelevant. So they've spent tens of billions of dollars, US taxpayer money, for the biggest intelligence apparatus on Earth. And then they dismiss its findings as irrelevant when they want to make a war. But the fact that it failed sends a message around the world, and especially in the global South. Every country is looking at this. It means the US is not all powerful and its weapons are not omnipotent. So Iran displayed a remarkable capacity to retaliate, to severely deplete Israel's missile defense system. It was absolutely committed to defending its sovereignty, and it said it will respond to every aggression. It will fight back, it will resist. So what is this hostility, this deep hatred that the US has for Iran? Why do they again and again seek to use their proxy, their pit bull in the region, that's what Israel is, as a way of attacking Iran, spreading the worst propaganda about Iran? It's really because of the Iranian Revolution of 1979, which had a profound and a lasting impact on Iran and on the entire Middle East, West Asia, and the wider world, because it led to the overthrow of the US-backed proxy, the Shah of Iran, and the establishment of an Islamic Republic. It fundamentally reshaped Iran's political, social, economic landscape. It's a revolution that triggered a regional power shift. That was the US main hold in the entire region, and they lost it. And a pro-Western monarchy, a feudal monarchy, was replaced with a republic that had enormous popularity. That led to the nationalization of all the major industries and a shift toward a more independent economy. This Iranian revolution brought about changes in social policies with an emphasis on expanding infrastructure and basic services in rural areas. And I want to just deal with what we're not told about Iran, some of the literacy and improved women's rights. Iran has always attacked on this. Some of the social indicators. Iran nationalized the key industries, and it sought to reduce dependency on foreign investment, and it aimed to create an independent economy and to restructure the feudal Iranian society. So what we're not told, just a few things about Iran, never mentioned in the corporate media here. Education is free in Iran, including university education, medical school, all the way through, or their private universities, where the tuition rate is about $100 a semester. There's an opportunities for financial aid while going to school. With everyone here who's literally burdened with decades of student debt knows what an impact that can make on your life. Life expectancy in Iran is about on par with the US, 77, 78 years. Iran has one of the most efficient healthcare systems in the US. It ranks in the top 30, far surpassing the US today. It provides free health care, free, for all children under the age of 7. It has a universal primary care network and really like universal health care in rural areas. In the U.S. health care, you know, we know in rural areas they have what they call health care deserts. Impossible to find a hospital or an emergency room. All the way back in 2010, Iran implemented a nationwide basic income plan. And it was one of the first plans globally to do this. Everyone has a basic income. It's been internationally applauded. It's never discussed in the media here. And there's also, by the way, a very important HIV prevention program. Drug use in Iran was decriminalized. The policy is instead focused on prevention. And we could compare that to the criminalization of drug use and its punitive aspect in the US, where it's really fills the privatized healthcare system that profits from targeting poor people. I want to say something about women in Iran, because always that's really a mantra that somehow US intervention is going to save Muslim women. And it's really tired BS, because it's US wars that destroy the lives of Muslim women for decades all over the world. But literacy among women in Iran prior to the Islamic Revolution in 1979, literacy rate was under 40%. And within a decade of the revolution, it was all the way up into the 90%. Now there's full literacy. Female students in universities outnumber male students. For over a decade, that's been true. In the science and technology, engineering, math graduates, 70% are women, 70%. That exceeds the US level. Professional and doctorate programs, 58% of students of Iranian professional doctorate programs are women. And participation, I have really these figures from almost 20 years ago, that women hold 27% of the ministerial posts. There were at that time 1,100 female judges, 25% of managerial roles in government. And that is increasing now. It can be very difficult to get translated into English some of the more current figures, but they continue to be pretty impressive. I could talk about maternity leave, which is really incredible, and free maternity cares, labor protection, which is really also very effective. Gender-affirming treatment has been legal since the 1980s, and the government subsidizes surgery, hormone therapy for trans individuals who have to be at least 18 years old, but it's quite an extraordinary program. There's an expansion of basic social services. And so much was based on the redistribution of the land and the revolution that took place at the really base level. A lot can't be finished or concluded because US sanctions are so extreme and severe on Iran. And it has made changes in the countryside that were huge, very difficult to do the backup that's needed. But for the landless and near landless peasantry who had been in feudal bondage, really serfs tied to the land, there was a complete change. So this is the reason that the US hates Iran, wants to destroy Iran. They want those nationalized industries of oil and gas, banking, automotive industries. These are nationalized industries. They want those profits here for themselves.
That was Director of the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders, speaking at a Pacifica Fight Back town hall on July 5. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Polina Vasiliev, Steve Seltzer, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, @PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.